Part 4. Knowledge. The pandemic. Into the notable city of Florence, fair over every other of Italy, there came the death-dealing pestilence, which had some years before appeared in the parts of the east and had now unhappily spread toward the west. To the cure of these maladies, nor counsel of physician, nor virtue of any medicine appeared to avail or profit aught. The mere touching of the clothes, or of whatsoever other thing had been touched or used of the sick, appeared of itself to communicate the malady to the toucher. Each thought to secure immunity for himself. Some lived removed from every other and shut themselves up in those houses where none had been sick and where living was best. Giovanni Boccaccio, The Decameron. In the early winter of 2020, before our self-assuredness was upended, it seemed as if the immune system, of all the complex cellular systems in the body, was the one that we understood the best. In 2018, when Allison and Hanjo were awarded the Nobel Prize for their discovery of how tumors evade T-cell immunity, the prize seemed to mark a crest in our understanding of immunity, and perhaps of cell biology in general. Powerful medicines were being created that could uncloak immunologically cloaked tumors. Fundamental mysteries remained, of course. How this system achieved the acrobatic balancing act between generating a forceful immune response against pathogens while ensuring that same response did not turn on our own bodies. How the Kampf against microbial invaders did not degenerate into the civil war of horror autotoxicus was still somewhat of a profound riddle. In Sam P's case, we could never control the autoimmune hepatitis induced by the cancer-rejecting immunotherapy. But the central pieces of the puzzle seem to have fallen into place. Several years ago, I spoke to a postdoctoral researcher who was transitioning from his university position to a job at a biotech company that planned to make novel immunological therapies for cancer. He told me that researchers were increasingly imagining the immune system as a knowable machine, with movable, manipulable, decipherable, changeable cogs, gears, and parts. I did not sense hubris in his optimism. In 2020, 8 of the approximately 50 drugs approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration involved the immune response. In 2018, that number was 12 of 59. Almost a fifth of all the human drugs being discovered had something to do with the immune system. We were stepping, it seemed, quite confidently from basic immunology to applied immunology. And then, biblically, we tumbled. On January 19, 2020, a 30-something man just off a flight from Wuhan, China, walked into a clinic in Snohomish County, Washington, with a cough. To read that first case report, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in March that year, is to experience an ascending chill. On checking into the clinic, the patient put on a mask in the waiting room. Who stood next to him in that room? How many people had he infected in the past days? Who was sitting across the aisle on the flight from Wuhan to Seattle? After waiting approximately 20 minutes, he was taken into an examination room and evaluated. Was the doctor who examined him masked? The nurse who checked his temperature? Where are they now? He disclosed that he had returned to Washington State on January 15th after traveling to visit family in Wuhan, China. On January 20th, a nasal swab and an oral swab, and subsequently stool samples, were sent to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Both tested positive for a novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. On the 9th day of his illness and the 5th day of hospitalization, his condition deteriorated. His oxygen levels dropped to 90%, decidedly abnormal for a young man with no prior lung condition. A chest X-ray revealed hazy, opaque streaks across his lung, signaling a deepening pneumonia. His liver function blood tests revealed abnormalities. High fevers came and went. He teetered on the brink of dying, but ultimately recovered. More than 2 years have passed since the man with a cough walked into the Seattle clinic. As I write this in March 2022, the world has recorded nearly 450 million infections, nearly 6 million deaths. Both numbers are likely vast underestimates, given the lack of reliable reporting of testing and deaths from the virus. The contagion has leapt across the globe, leaving virtually no corner untouched. Waves of viral strains bearing new mutations have appeared, some more lethal than others, Alpha, Delta, and now Omicron. More than 60 vaccines against the virus are undergoing clinical tests. 3 have been approved in the United States, 9 approved by the World Health Organization, WHO, and several others are still in development. Wealthy nations with mature health care and delivery systems have been brought to their knees. The United Kingdom has had more than 160,000 deaths. In the United States, the official number of deaths is 965,000. And the counts of the dead, the sick, the ravaged, the displaced, the bankrupted, the bereaved, goes on and on. I cannot shake the images or the sounds of the pandemic. Who can? The orange body bags piled in bunks in makeshift morgues, the mass graves in Chile, the constant wailing of ambulance sirens outside my hospital, fusing together until all I could hear was a wall of shrieks. The emergency room in the spring of 2021 packed to its brim with stretchers spilling into the corridors, the patients gasping as they drowned in their own fluids. The ICU scrambling for more beds every day, the exhausted doctors and nurses every evening as they zombied their way across the crosswalk outside my office with that hollow-eyed post-shift look and the characteristic marks on their faces where the edges of the N95 masks had cut into their cheeks. The withdrawn, empty cities with brown paper bags blowing on the streets. The looks of suspicion or frank terror when a man on the subway coughed or sneezed. The photograph of a friend's cousin, a healthy, vigorous 40-something Brazilian man, on a beach in Rio de Janeiro 2 summers ago, his arms lifted joyfully above the water. In late July 2021, he fell sick with the virus. His pneumonia worsened. His breathing rate climbed to the 30s. I can only imagine a second image. The same man in an ICU bed straining to breathe so hard that the strap muscles on his neck are taut and visible. His lips blue. His arms are lifted again, but flailing. Lifted not to express joy, but to signal a desire for survival. I exchanged urgent texts night after night with my friend, and for a while felt reassured. The cousin was on a ventilator, but improving, albeit slowly. And then, the final text, received sometime late at night on April 9th, "I'm sorry, but he passed." A second wave that moved through India in April 2021 was vastly more lethal than the first. The virus had mutated into a strain now called the Delta strain, much more infectious and possibly more lethal than the original strain that had come from Wuhan. Delta rampaged through India, decimating its already shattered public health system and revealing the shocking absence of an organized, coordinated response. Delhi closed down, leaving millions of migrant workers stranded. My mother was a lone prisoner in her flat in the city. Over the weeks and weeks of confinement, her daily texts to me shortened into a Morse code of reassurance. Today, okay. I cannot shake from my mind the picture of a migrant laborer from New Delhi on his knees outside the hospital, begging for a cylinder of oxygen for his family. A 65-year-old journalist from Lucknow tweeted that he was infected, febrile, short of breath, but his phone calls to hospitals and doctors went unheeded. The tweets, ricocheting through cyberspace, spelled out an escalating catalog of desperation. As the world watched in abject horror, he sent out pictures of his oxygen levels falling. 52%, 31%, levels incompatible with living. In the last tweet, there is an image of him holding a pulse oximeter with blue fingers. Oxygen level, 30%. And then there were no more messages. There were days that I dared not open the newspaper. It was as if we had reinvented the phases of grief, anger turning into blame, and then helplessness. India burned so briskly that every system, every grid, collapsed, corroded, and melted. I think sometimes of a legend. Bali, a demon king, has conquered 3 worlds, the earth, the underworld, and the heavens. A tiny man with smoky eyes and an umbrella, Vamana, Vishnu's avatar, appears before him and asks him to grant him a single wish. His arrogance inflated into munificence, Bali, the demon king, agrees. Vamana asks for something ludicrously small, a square plot of land whose edges are defined by the distance that he might cover in three strides. The man is, what, two arm lengths tall? He wants a few square feet of a kingdom that stretches to infinity? Bali laughs it off. Yes, of course, the little man can have his little plot of land. And then, as Bali watches in terror, Vamana expands. His body arches exponentially through the skies. His first step crosses the entire earth. His second stretches across the heavens. The third arcs over the netherworld. There is no more kingdom to grant. He plants his foot on Bali's head and pushes him into the lower reaches of hell. The analogy fails quite obviously in some parts. Vamana was a divine being, and the virus was anything but a divine intervention. Our failings, unfortunately, were all too human. A fraying, sclerotic global public health system, the absence of preparedness, misinformation that spread virus-like through nations, supply chain issues that made it impossible to procure protective masks and disposable medical suits, strongmen leaders of nations who turned out to be flaccid in their responses to the viral contagion. But the foot planted on our head was real. Just when we felt that we knew the cell biology of the immune system, when our confidence had crested, scientists' heads were pushed into the lower reaches of hell. When a diminutive microbe began to cross worlds, leaping from continent to continent, very little made sense. As Akiko Iwasaki, a virologist at Yale, told me, coronaviruses similar to SARS-CoV-2 had circulated through human populations for millennia, but none had caused this kind of devastation. Some cousin viruses, like SARS and MERS, were deadlier than CoV-2, but they had been rapidly contained. What feature of the interaction between SARS-CoV-2 and human cells enabled this virus to precipitate a global pandemic? Two clues came from a medical report from a German clinic that, at first glance, hardly read ominously. In January 2020, in retrospect, how innocent, how self-assured we seem to have been during that short-lived calm, how much kingdom could a three-foot man claim? A 33-year-old man from Munich had a business meeting with a woman from Shanghai. A few days later, he fell ill, with fever, headache, and flu-like symptoms. He recuperated at home and went back to work, holding meetings with several other colleagues. A fever, a headache, and a quick recovery. An everyday infection. A common case of a common cold. A few days later, the hospital in Munich called the man in. The Shanghai woman had fallen ill on her flight back to China. She had tested positive for SARS-CoV-2. But here was the puzzle. She had had no symptoms when she had met him. She had seemed perfectly well. She had only fallen ill 2 days later. In short, she had transmitted the virus to the man while being pre-symptomatic. No one could have told her or the exposed man that she had been a carrier of the virus. No isolation or quarantine based on symptoms could have stopped the virus. The mystery deepened when the man was tested. His symptoms had defervesced by then. He had returned to work, feeling perfectly well, but when the virus was measured in his sputum, he turned out to be a roiling cauldron of contagion. There were 100 million infectious viral particles per milliliter of spit. Just a few coughs might fill a room with a dense, invisible, deeply contagious fog. He, too, was transmitting virus while experiencing no discernible symptoms. As the contact tracing continued, the second ominous feature of the virus emerged. The man had infected three other people. The contagiousness of the virus, a key factor in determining the course of the growth of an infection, was at least three. If one person can infect three, the growth of infections is necessarily exponential. 3, 9, 27, 81. In 20 cycles, the number reaches 3,486,784,401, about half the population of the globe. Asymptomatic/pre-symptomatic transmission, exponential growth. The two critical ingredients in the recipe for a pandemic had already been established by that innocuous-seeming report. The third was soon to become apparent: unpredictable, mysterious deadliness. By then, who had not seen the grainy photograph captured on a cell phone camera of the ophthalmologist from Wuhan who had dared to report the first cases? He is drenched in perspiration and gasping to breathe as he battles the pneumonia that will eventually kill him. As the infection spread, the world woke up to its macabre lethality. In Seattle, New York, Rome, London, and Madrid, the ICUs filled up and the body counts kept rising. And the questions arose just as furiously. What was the basis of pre-symptomatic infections? And how could a virus that caused relatively mild infections in some turn so lethal in others? Why, you might ask, do the medical mysteries of the COVID-19 pandemic sit at the center of a book on cell biology? Because cell biology sits at the center of the medical mysteries. Everything we understood about cells and their interactions with each other, how the innate immune system responds to a pathogen, how immune cells communicate with each other, how a virus growing so tenaciously inside a lung cell can cause a pre-symptomatic infection without alerting other cells around it, how the cells of the gastrointestinal system may act as first responders to a pathogen, has to be rethought and dissected. The pandemic demands autopsies of many kinds, but an autopsy of our knowledge about cell biology is also necessary. I could not write this book without writing about COVID. In 2020, a group of Dutch researchers looking for genes that might increase susceptibility to severe COVID found the glimpse of an answer. The group identified two sibling pairs from different families, four young men, who had suffered unusually aggressive forms of the disease. Genetic sequencing revealed that one pair had inherited an inactivating mutation in a gene, TLR7. Fraternal siblings, on average, will have half their genes in common. Astonishingly, the second pair of brothers had also inherited a mutation in that very gene that appeared to decrease its activity. The exact mutation was different, but it was in the same gene. What about the TLR7 gene might explain its involvement with such severe consequences of SARS-CoV-2 infection? Recall the innate immune system, which responds to patterns or signals of danger sent out by cells during the very first phases of an infection. Well, before the innate system can be activated, the cell first has to detect the invasion. TLR7, or toll-like receptor 7, it turns out, is one of the key detectors of viral invasion. It's a molecular sensor built into cells that is turned on when the cell is infected by a virus. The activation of TLR7, in turn, galvanizes a cell's danger signals. Among them, a molecule called type 1 interferon, to alert other cells to amplify their antiviral defenses and to jumpstart the immune response. The theory is that mutations in TLR7 in both sibling pairs had somehow inactivated the protein or decreased its function. As a consequence, the secretion of type 1 interferon, the danger signal, was blunted. The invasion wasn't detected, the alarm bell never went off, and the innate immune system never reacted adequately. Something about the functional impairment of the early innate cellular response to viral infection had made the two pairs of Dutch brothers susceptible to the severest form of disease caused by SARS-CoV-2. As scientists flocked to study SARS-CoV-2 and its interaction with immunity, more suggestive clues emerged. At Ben Tenuver's lab in New York, researchers discovered that soon after infection, the virus reprograms the infected cell. In January 2020, I spoke to Tenuver, a 40-year-old immunologist who works at Mount Sinai Hospital. "It's almost as if the virus hijacked the cell," he told me. The cellular hijack involves an uncannily devious trick, even as it converts the cell into a factory to produce millions of virions. SARS-CoV-2 stops the infected cell from secreting type 1 interferon. At Rockefeller University in New York, Jean-Laurent Casanova converged on the same conclusion. The most severe cases of SARS-CoV-2 infection, he found, occurred in patients, typically men, who lacked the ability to elicit a functional type 1 interferon signal after infection. At times, cell biology produces the most peculiar and unexpected of results. These men with severe COVID had pre-existing autoantibodies against type 1 interferon. For example, their bodies had attacked and rendered the protein non-functional even before they had been infected. These patients were already deficient in the type 1 interferon response, but were unaware of their deficiency until the virus struck. For them, COVID infection had unveiled a long-standing but previously invisible autoimmune disease, a dormant, unknowable horror autotoxicus against type 1 interferon, the viral alarm bell, that was only revealed by SARS-CoV-2 infection. The studies began to fit together, like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. The virus was most deadly when it infected a host whose early antiviral response had been functionally paralyzed, like a raider that had come into an unlocked house, as one writer described it. The pathogenicity of SARS-CoV-2, in short, perhaps lay precisely in its ability to dupe cells into believing that it is not pathogenic. More data poured in. The infected host cell, with its impaired ability to send out an initial danger signal, wasn't simply an unlocked house. Rather, it was an unlocked house with not one but two dysfunctional alarm systems. It couldn't summon an early alert, type 1 interferon among the signals, but as the house burned, the cell yanked the trigger on a powerful second alarm, sending out a separate series of danger signals, cytokines, to summon immune cells. An uncoordinated army of cells, confused, bamboozled soldiers, surged into the sites of infection and started a carpet bombing program. It was too much, too late. The trigger-happy immune cells poured out a fog of toxins to contain the virus. The war against the virus, as much as the virus itself, became an escalating crisis. The lungs were bogged with fluid. Debris from dead cells clogged the air sacs. There appears to be a fork in the road to immunity to COVID-19 that determines disease outcome, Iwasaki told me. If you mount a robust innate immune response during the early phase of infection, presumably via an intact type 1 interferon response, you control the virus and have a mild disease. If you don't, you have uncontrolled virus replication in the lung that fuels the fire of inflammation leading to severe disease. Iwasaki used a particularly vivid phrase to describe this kind of hyperactive dysfunctional inflammation. She called it immunological misfiring. Why or how does the virus cause immunological misfiring? We don't know. How does it hijack the cell's interferon response? We have a few hints, but no definitive answer. Is it the timing of the response? The impairment of early phase followed by hyperactivity of the late phase the main problem? We don't know. What about the role of T cells that detect bits of viral protein in infected cells? Could they provide some protection against the severity of viral infection? Some evidence suggests that T-cell immunity can dampen the severity of infection, but other studies don't support the degree of protection. We don't know. Why does the virus cause more severe disease in men than in women? Again, there are hypothetical answers, but we lack definitive ones. Why do some people generate potent neutralizing antibodies after infection, while others don't? Why do some suffer long-term consequences of the infection, including chronic fatigue, dizziness, brain fog, hair loss, and breathlessness, among a host of other symptoms? We don't know. The monotony of answers is humbling, maddening. We don't know. We don't know. We don't know. Pandemics teach us about epidemiology, but they also teach us about epistemology, how we know what we know. SARS-CoV-2 has forced us to point our most powerful scientific flashlights on the immune system, resulting in arguably the most intense scrutiny that this community of cells and the signals that move between them has ever been subject to. But perhaps what we think we understand about SARS-CoV-2 is limited to what we already know about the immune system. For example, the known knowns. We cannot know the unknown unknowns. And perhaps the pandemic has pointed to another gap in our understanding. Perhaps other viruses, like SARS-CoV-2, have unexpected ways of contorting the cells of the immune system that results in their pathogenicity. And we've just ignored these deeper explanations. Indeed, we know of such mechanisms in viruses such as cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr virus. The story we've told ourselves about why SARS-CoV-2 is so devious at hijacking our immune systems is, perhaps, a totally incomplete story. Our understanding of the true complexities of the immune system has been partially shoved back into its black box. Science hunts for truths. There's a haunting image in one of Zadie Smith's essays that involves a cartoon of Charles Dickens surrounded by all the characters that he's invented. Tubby Mr. Pickwick in an ill-fitting waistcoat, adventurous David Copperfield in a top hat, bedraggled and innocent little Nell. Smith is writing about authors, in particular about the out-of-body, in-another-mind experience that a fiction writer feels when she fully inhabits the mind, body, and world of a character that she's created. That familiarity, or intimacy, feels like a truth. Dickens didn't look worried or ashamed, Smith writes of the cartoon, didn't appear to suspect he might be schizophrenic or in some other way pathological. He had a name for his condition, novelist. Imagine another character now, except surrounded by half-ghosts. Some of these characters, like type 1 interferon, the toll-like receptor or the neutrophil, are mostly visible, except they exist in the half-light of visibility. We think we know and understand them, but we don't, really. Some only cast shadows, some are completely invisible, some mislead us about their identities, and there are others around us whose presence we cannot even sense. We haven't even met them or named them yet. I, too, have a name for this condition, scientist. We look, we create, we imagine, but find only incomplete explanations for phenomena, even phenomena we may have partially discovered through our own work. We cannot inhabit their minds. COVID exposed the humility that is required to cohabitate with these characters surrounding us. We are like Dickens, except encircled by shadows, ghosts, and liars. As one physician told me, we don't even know what we don't know. There's an alternative story, a triumphalist narrative that can also be told about the pandemic. It goes this way. Immunologists and virologists, building on decades of investigation into the fundamentals of cell biology and immunity, developed vaccines against SARS-CoV-2 in record time, some less than a year after the man from Wuhan had entered the Seattle clinic. Many of these vaccines functioned with entirely new methods of eliciting immunity, an altered chemical form of mRNA, for instance, again using decades of knowledge of how immune cells detect foreign proteins and how they might stave off infections. But triumphalism fails in the face of more than 6 million deaths. The pandemic energized immunology, but it also exposed gaping fissures in our understanding. It provided a necessary dose of humility. I cannot think of a scientific moment that has revealed such deep and fundamental shortcomings in our knowledge of the biology of a system that we had thought we knew. We have learned so much. We have so much left to learn. Part 5. Organs. We've spoken a lot about organs, but we haven't really met one yet. Blood, which we encountered as a model of cellular cooperation and communication, is not a simple organ. It is, rather, a system of organs. One to deliver oxygen, red cells, and another to respond to injury, platelets, and yet another to respond to infections and inflammation. Some of its systems have yet other systems within them. There's innate immunity, neutrophils and macrophages that have an inbuilt capacity to detect and kill pathogens that cooperates with learned immunity, B and T cells that adapt and learn to make a specific immune response to the pathogen. In biology, an organ is defined as a structural or anatomic unit in which cells come together to serve a common purpose. In smaller animals, even a small collection of cells will serve the purpose. The nematode worm, C. elegans, which many biologists study, has a nervous system consisting of 302 neurons. That's about 300 million-fold fewer than neurons found in the human brain. As organisms grew bigger and more complex, organs, too, grew necessarily bigger and more complex. But the fundamental defining feature of organs, a common purpose, the citizenship of cells that Virchow had imagined, remained and still remains constant. In animals, organs are anatomically defined so that the cells that reside in the organ can act in concert as citizen cells to enable physiology. The cells and organs, as we shall see, still utilize the basic principles of cell biology, protein synthesis, metabolism, waste disposal, autonomy. But each cell in each organ is also a specialist. It acquires a unique function that serves the organ as a whole and ultimately coordinates some aspect of human physiology. Human organs and their cells thus had to acquire more and more specialized functions. A roundworm can breathe through its skin, but humans need a lung. And in megacellular organisms, such as humans, there are oceanic distances to cover. The pancreas sends insulin to cells in the toes with every heartbeat, a longer distance than most nematodes travel in their lifetimes. Cellular specialization and citizenship, the hallmarks of the cell biology of an organ, result in the profound emergent properties of human physiology. For example, properties that can only emerge when multiple cells coordinate their functions and work together. A heartbeat, a thought, and the restoration of constancy, the orchestration of homeostasis. To understand the biology of humans, then, we need to understand organs. And to understand organs, their dysfunctions and disease, and the possibility of rebuilding them, we must understand the biology of the cells that make them work. The citizen cell. The benefits of belonging. The crowd, suddenly there where there was nothing before, is a mysterious and universal phenomenon. A few people may have been standing together, 5, 10, or 12, not more. Nothing has been announced, nothing is expected. Suddenly, everywhere is black with people, and more come streaming from all sides as though the streets had only one direction. Elias Canetti, Crowds and Power. For the concept of a circuit of blood does not destroy, but rather advances traditional medicine. William Harvey, 1649. For months, during the early deadening days of the pandemic in New York, I found myself unable to write. As a doctor, I was considered an essential worker, and so essential work carried on. Between February and August 2020, as the contagion swirled like a virulent tornado around the city, I went to my office at Columbia, donned my requisite N95, and tended to my patients who needed care. The cancer center was still running, albeit with minimal staff. Somehow, we managed to keep essential chemotherapy, transfusions, and procedures on schedule. Some of my patients contracted the virus. A 60-something woman with pre-leukemia, another with myeloma whose stem cell transplant had to be pushed back, but thankfully, there were only 2 ICU admissions and no deaths. The rest recovered. But my emotions were robotic, and my mind was blank. I stared at the screen, often until 1 or 2 at night, produced a paragraph or two, and then junked them in the trash bin every morning. What I felt wasn't writer's block, but writer's languish. I wrote, yes, but everything that I put on the page seemed to lack life and energy. What preoccupied me was the collapse of infrastructure and of homeostasis that we had witnessed during the worst of the crisis in the United States, and then around the world. When my frustration reached its crest, I near regurgitated an essay, later published in The New Yorker. It was part cri de coeur, part plea for change, part autopsy of what I had witnessed in the middle of the pandemic. Medicine, I wrote, isn't a doctor with a black bag. It's a complex web of systems and processes, and systems that we had thought were self-regulating and self-correcting, like a human body in good health, turned out to be exquisitely sensitive to turbulence, like the body during critical illness. I had spent nearly a year thinking about bodies succumbing to illness, about a cellular system poised for battle against invaders, but as the spring of 2021 approached, the constant metaphors of the battle had become denervating. I wanted to think about normalcy and about restoration, about cellular systems that form the infrastructure of human physiology, and conversely, of the future repair and restoration of the human systems that had failed. I wanted to write about homeostasis and self-correction. I was exhausted by my mulling about how the body recognizes things, viruses that do not belong. I wanted to turn to citizenship, to belonging. The heart, of all organs in the body, epitomizes belonging. We use the word belong to signify attachment or love, and the heart has been the central signifier of that feeling for millennia. Although, of course, we now know that much of emotional life sits in the brain. When you say, "My heart belongs to you," you signify the link between that organ and attachment. As a child, my heart belonged to my mother. My father was a distant presence, reliable and gentle, but reserved, somehow unreachable. His mother, my grandmother, lived with us. Scarred by her move during partition, she kept to a room by herself, cooked her own food and washed her own clothes, almost as if a house was a temporary shelter that might be snatched from her hands at any time. Her belongings, largely untouched and still packed in sheets of newspaper, sat in the steel trunk that she had ferried across the border from East Pakistan into India. Aside from a bed and a threadbare mattress, her room had nothing else. She had separated from the possibility of separation. I have no memory of her touching me. Her heart had been broken. My transition into manhood marked a different relationship with my father. As a student at Stanford, in a world before cell phones and email, I began to write to him. At first, our letters were brief and stilted, but over time, they grew longer and warmer. I began to understand him in a new light. His loss of home seemed familiar. In 1946, he had been uprooted from his village when he was barely a teenager, stuffed into an overnight ferry bound for Kolkata, a city on the edge of a nervous breakdown. In the late 50s, he had moved again as a young executive to Delhi, a city as culturally and socially alien to a young man from East Bengal as the frisbee-slinging, froyo-guzzling, beer-ponging life of my California dorm seemed to me. In 1989, 5 weeks into my first term, San Francisco was hit by the Loma Prieta earthquake, a shuddering of such magnitude that as I stood under the lintel of my dorm room door, I saw the corridor buckle and a sine wave move through the cement, as if I were standing on the back of a serpent that had suddenly been awoken. My father heard the news and immediately wrote to me. In 1960, when he was building his first house in Delhi, an earthquake had decimated the one-story structure into which he had poured all his savings. He told me, he had told no one, that he had spent the night sitting on the foundation, surrounded by the crumbled rafters, weeping. I longed to be back home, even for a short while. One afternoon, I picked up my mail and found a heavy packet. He had surprised me with tickets to return to Delhi in my first winter. I was supposed to stay in California until the next summer. It was a 16-hour flight, and I slept through it until the fog-choked lights of the city came into view, and the plane made that elephant screech sound of the wheel hatch opening just before landing. Since that trip, I must have flown to India 4 dozen times, but it is a sound that makes my heart bound with a strange joy. The man at customs asked me for a small bribe, and I felt like hugging him. I was home. I can still feel the boom of my heartbeat as I exited the airport. I could tell you about the neural cascade I experienced, the memories flooding back, the release of epinephrine in my blood. But while the stimulus was triggered in the brain, the experience was felt in my heart. My father was there, as he would be year after year when I returned, with a white shawl draped around himself and an extra one to wrap around me. Coming back. Belonging. Beyond metaphors, the heart is actually an organ where the belonging and citizenship among cells is of crucial importance. What makes heart cells special? What allows them to perform the precisely coordinated activity, second upon second, day after day, that we recognize as the heartbeat? Contemplate the heartbeat. This phenomenon that many of us might consider the epitome of the everyday, the heart will beat more than 2 billion times over an average person's life, is, in fact, a miraculously complex feat of cell biology. The heart is a model of cellular cooperation, citizenship, and belonging. Aristotle, for one, thought of the heart as the first among equals, the most important citizen of all organs, the center of vitality in the body. The other organs that clustered around the heart, he proposed, were there just as heating and cooling chambers, The lungs were like bellows, expanding and contracting to keep the engine cool. The liver was a glorified heat sink, diverting the excess heat produced by the most vital of organs, lest it overheat. Galen of Pergamon propelled the idea forward. The heart is, as it were, the hearthstone and source of the innate heat by which the animal is governed. But the heart's centrality to human life, so much so that all the other organs were mere heating and cooling pipes for its engine, begged the question, what does this organ do? The medieval physiologist Ibn Sina, or Avicenna, who lived around AD 1000, tried to tackle the question in a majestic treatise that he named Al-Kanun Fi'd-Tib, the Canon of Medicine. The word canon can also be translated as law. Ibn Sina was looking for universal laws that govern physiology. Ibn Sina concentrated on the pulse, noting its wave-like quality and its correlation with the heart's pulsation. When the pulse was irregular, so, too, was the heartbeat, and palpitations caused symptoms such as fainting or lethargy. When the heartbeat became thready, so did the pulse, and the symptoms portended death. Anxiety increased the pulse concomitantly with the heartbeat, and Ibn Sina noted so did lovesickness, longing, or belonging. A friend told me the story of visiting a Tibetan doctor who specialized in pulses. The doctor asked him a few perfunctory questions and then checked his pulse. "You've gone through a terrible breakup," the doctor said. "Your life isn't going to be the same again." The Tibetan doctor was right. Something about the pulse, its rapidity or its dullness, had provided a clue about the longing and belonging. My friend's breakup and life had forever been uprooted. Ibn Sina's description of the heart as a source of pulsation, in essence a pump, was one of the earliest attempts to describe its function. But it was English physiologist William Harvey, working in the 1600s, who fully described the conjoined circuitry of the heart as pump in the human body. Harvey trained in medicine in Padua and then returned to Cambridge to continue his medical studies. In 1609, he was appointed a physician at St. Bartholomew's Hospital with an annual salary of £33. Short and round-faced, quote, eyes small, round, very black and full of spirit, his hair as black as a raven and curling, close quote, he was a man of simple tastes. He lived in a small house in run-down Ludgate, even though his position as hospital physician gave him access to two much larger houses near the hospital. It's tempting to connect his material austerity to the austerity of his experimental methods. Using nothing more than bands and tourniquets, and an occasional pinch of an artery or vein, Harvey set out to solve a problem that had confounded physiologists for centuries. We've already encountered Harvey's orthodoxy dismantling inquisitive mind in embryology and physiology. He was among the strongest critics of the idea that the embryo came preformed in the womb, or that blood was the warming oil of the body, but it was his seminal work on the heart and circulation that was Harvey's most significant scientific contribution. Harvey didn't have the use of powerful microscopes, so he used the simplest physiological experiments to understand the workings of the heart. He punctured the arteries of animals and found that when the blood had drained from them, the veins were also eventually emptied of blood. Hence, he concluded, arteries and veins must be connected in a circuit. When he pinched the aorta, the heart swelled up with blood. When he pinched the main veins, the heart was drained of blood. Hence, the aorta must lead blood out of the heart, and the veins must lead blood into the heart. A conclusion so manifestly central to the understanding of circulation that it is unfathomable that it had eluded generations of physiologists. Most importantly, when he examined the septum, the wall between the left and right sides of the heart, he found it too thick and without any pores in it. Hence, the blood from the left side must travel to the lungs first before it re-entered the right side. A direct assault on the beliefs of Galen and early anatomists that blood moved through the lungs before reaching the heart. When Harvey watched the heart beating, he saw it contracting and relaxing. Hence, the heart must be the pump that sends the blood in a circuit around the body, from arteries to veins and back. In 1628, Harvey published his conclusions in a 7-volume series now typically referred to as De Motu Cordis, an anatomical account of the motion of the heart and blood that would upset the very foundations of anatomy and physiology of the heart. The heart, Harvey argued, was a pump that moved blood circuitously through the body, from arteries to veins and back again. These views, he wrote, pleased some more, others less. Some calumniated me and laid it to me a crime that I had dared to depart from the precepts and opinions of all anatomists. Others desired further explanation of the novelties which they said were both worthy of consideration and might perchance be found of signal use. We now know in part from Harvey's work on the anatomy of the heart that the heart is, in fact, two pumps, one left and one right, laid side by side, like twins in a womb. See the drawing in the attached PDF. It's all a circle, so let's begin with the right side. The right-sided pump collects blood from the veins of the body. Exhausted and depleted, having delivered oxygen and nutrients to the organs, venous blood, often darker red than bright crimson, pours into the upper right chamber called the right atrium. It then passes through a valve and is moved into the pumping chamber, the right ventricle. A powerful heave from the right ventricle pumps the blood to the lungs. This is the right-sided circuit, veins to heart to lung. The lungs, having received blood from the right side of the heart, oxygenate the blood and clear the carbon dioxide. Replete with oxygen and cleansed, blood, now a vivid crimson, moves to the left side. It collects in the left atrium of the heart. It is then pushed into the left ventricle. It is this left ventricle, perhaps the most tireless muscle in the body, that ejects the blood forcefully into the wide arc of the aorta, the major blood vessel that carries oxygenated blood to the body and to the brain. Round and round in circles. The concept of a circuit of blood does not destroy, but rather advances medicine, Harvey wrote. But to imagine the heart mechanically, as a pump, is to forget the central conundrum. How do you make a pump out of cells? A pump is, after all, a highly coordinated machine. It needs a signal to dilate and a signal to compress. It needs valves to ensure that the fluid doesn't flow backwards. It requires a mechanism to ensure that the contracting bladder doesn't wobble without purpose or direction. An uncoordinated pump is no better than a wobbling balloon. On January 17, 1912, Alexis Carrel, a French scientist at the Rockefeller Institute in New York, cut a small fragment of the heart of an 18-day-old chick fetus and grew it in liquid culture. The fragment pulsated regularly for a few days and grew extensively, he noted. After the first washing, the culture grew again very extensively. When he removed and recultivated a piece of it, he found it still capable of pulsating. In March, nearly 3 months after having removed it from the chick's heart, it was still pulsating at a rate that varied between 60 and 84 per minute. Ultimately, on March 12th, the pulsations were irregular, and the fragment beat for a series of 3 to 4 pulsations and then stopped for about 20 seconds. Over the course of about 3 months, the piece of chick heart in a petri dish had generated about 9 million heartbeats. Carrel's experiment was widely heralded as proof that organs could live and function outside the body, but it also signaled an equally important idea. The cells of the heart, cultivated outside the body, had the autonomous capacity to pulsate rhythmically. Something intrinsic about the cells made them capable of pump-like action, coordinated pulsation. That same year, W.T. Porter, a physiologist at Harvard, had shown that severing the nerves from a dog's heart still enabled the ventricles to pulsate autonomously, a live demonstration of what Carrel had shown in a petri dish. The coordinated pulsation of the heart's cells fascinated physiologists. In the 1880s, German biologist Friedrich Bitter had noted that the cells of the heart branch and intercommunicate, forming a continuum. They form a consortium of sorts, a citizenry of cells. The source of their contractile power seemed to lie in their togetherness, their belonging. But how was that contractile power generated? In the 1940s, a Hungarian-born physiologist, Albert Szent-Györgyi, began to investigate how a cell might acquire the ability to contract and relax. By then, he had already established himself as one of the most eminent physiologists of his generation. He had won the Nobel Prize for discovering vitamin C and studied how the cell generates energy. Much of what we know about the mitochondrial reactions that make energy molecules emerge from this work. He was a man of powerful convictions and itinerant curiosity. Conscripted to the medical corps during World War I, he became so disgusted with the carnage and disillusioned by the war that he shot himself in the arm, claimed to have been injured by enemy gunfire, and was therefore able to resume his scientific and medical studies. He moved from university to university, lab to lab, and city to city, Prague, Berlin, Cambridge, England, and Woods Hole in Massachusetts, studying the biochemistry of cellular respiration, the physiology of acids and bases in the body, and vitamins and biochemical reactions essential for life. By the 1940s, his infinitely curious mind had turned to the study of cardiac muscle. The question that preoccupied him was essential to understanding the function of the heart. How is its pumping force generated? Szentgyörgyi began with Virchow's idea. If an organ is capable of contracting and dilating, then its cells must be capable of contraction and dilation. Sitting within each muscle cell, Szentgyörgyi mused, must be some specialized molecule, or set of molecules, that was capable of generating a directional force, thereby shortening the cell, contracting it. In order to make a system which can shorten, he wrote, nature has to use thin and long protein particles. By then, one of the thin and long proteins had already been identified. He wrote, the thread-like, very thin and long protein particles out of which nature has built the contractile matter is myosin. But a thin long protein is merely a rope. Tether the rope to the ends of a cell, and you begin to have the basic elements of a contractile apparatus. But how is this system of ropes pulled tight and loosened? Szentgyörgyi and his colleagues found that fibers of myosin are intimately connected to another dense, organized network of long and thin fibers, composed mainly of a protein called actin. In short, there were two systems of interconnected fibers inside a muscle cell, actin and myosin. The trick to a muscle cell's contraction is that these two fibers, actin and myosin, slide against each other, like two networks of ropes. When a cell is stimulated to contract, a part of the myosin fiber binds to a site on the actin fiber, like a hand from one rope grasping the other. It then unclutches it and reaches forward to bind to the next site. A man suspended on one rope, grasping and pulling on the other, one fist upon the next. Clutch, pull, release. Clutch, pull, release. Each muscle cell has thousands of such lined ropes, bands of actin in parallel with bands of myosin. There are three fundamental kinds of muscle cells in the human body: cardiac muscle, which constitutes the main subject of this chapter, skeletal muscle, the kind that moves your arms on command, and smooth muscle, the kind that moves involuntarily but consistently, allowing, say, liquid in the intestines to keep moving. All three muscles use variants of the actin-myosin system, along with a smattering of other proteins for contractility. As the ropes, lined side by side, slide against each other, clutch, pull, release, the edges of the cell are also yanked, and the cell is dragged into a contraction. The process requires energy, of course, and every heart cell and muscle cell is chock full of mitochondria to supply the energy required for the two fibers to slide. A quick aside here, one peculiarity of the system is that it is the release of actin from myosin, not the binding of the fibers, that requires energy. When an organism dies and the source of energy is lost, the muscle fibers, unable to unclasp their fists, are caught in a permanent grip, bound. The cellular ropes in every muscle tighten. The body hardens and contracts into the permanent clasp of death, the phenomenon that we call rigor mortis. But this describes the contractile journey of one cell. For the heart to function as an organ, all its cells must contract in the coordinated order. And this is where Friedrich Bitter's observation that the cells of the heart muscle seem to form a continuum becomes critical. In the 1950s, microscopists would discover that heart cells are connected to each other through minuscule molecular channels called gap junctions, In other words, every cell is inherently designed to communicate with the next. Although many, they behave as one. When a stimulus to contract is generated in one cell, it automatically travels to the next cell, resulting in its stimulation and ultimately resulting in contraction in unison. What is that stimulus? It's the movement of ions, principally calcium, in and out of cells through specialized channels on the membranes of heart cells. In its resting state, the heart cell has low levels of calcium. When it is stimulated to contract, calcium floods into a heart cell and it instigates contraction. And calcium's entry is a self-feeding loop. The entry of calcium releases more calcium from the heart cell, resulting in a sharp, steep spike in calcium levels. The interconnections between the cells, those junctions that were identified in the 1950s, carry the ionic message from cell to cell. The one becomes the many. Crowds generate power. The organ, a continuum of cells, thus behaves as a whole. There are two final cellular elements of the heart that are essential to its function. First, there are valves between the chambers to ensure that blood does not flow backward. The cells of the atria, the collecting chambers, contract first, sending blood into the ventricles. The valves between the atria and ventricles close, making a flapping noise, lub, the first heart sound. And after that, the cells of the ventricle contract in a similarly coordinated manner. The outlet valves of the ventricles close, dub, the second heart sound, lub dub, the sound of a citizenry in lockstep working together. The final element of a pump is a rhythm generator, or a metronome. Physiologists found that specialized nerve-like cells, resident in the heart, generate paced rhythmic electrical impulses that stimulate the contraction. Yet other nerves, fast-conducting electrical wires, carry these impulses throughout the heart, first to the atria and then to the ventricles. Once the impulse reaches one cell, the junctions between the cells ensure that all cells contract together. The result is a miraculous coordination. Atrial contraction, ventricular contraction. The heart's cells form an orchestrated citizenship. Each cell of the heart muscle maintains its identity. But each cell is so intimately connected to the next that when the impulse to contract arrives, the contraction is purposeful and coordinated. The heart doesn't wobble. Its ventricles contract in one potent push. We might imagine the organ as if it behaves almost as a single-minded cell.